What happens if we flip the traditional way of sharing medical information to the wider population on its head? What happens if instead of letting algorithms or the zeitgeist of the moment order our social media feeds, we go straight to the source of clinical medicine and ask practicing experts what they see day in, day out, and give them an unedited platform to help disseminate practical medical information straight from the specialist? Dr. Ben Hunley.
Dr. Christopher, nice to see you today.
And you. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Would you mind giving us a little introduction?
My name's Dr. Ben Hunley. I'm a consultant in pain management and also anaesthesia. I work in Queen's Hospital in Romford, which is out of northeast London. And I used to practice in the private sector in the City of London, which is, of course, where I know you.
And that's where we met.
It is.
So thank you for agreeing to come chat today. So the working title, so this is a trial recording, but the working title is Straight from the Specialist. So I would like to, if all goes well, produce a podcast where I interview different consultants from different specialties. And I ask them three questions. So you've had them, but I'm going to, for the sake of the audience, just repeat them. So my first question is, what concept would you like to share with the general public?
With respect to pain management?
Yeah, so your area of expertise. So you're a consultant in... Yeah, pain is something that I would like to talk about. I know you're an anaesthetist, but...
Yeah, so the bulk of my work now is chronic pain and pain management. And chronic pain's a huge problem. Mm. Something like 30% of the population experience chronic musculoskeletal pain. Something like 11% of the population state themselves to be severely functionally impaired by long-term pain. So it's a huge problem. And obviously there's many different sorts of pain experience. There's many different sites of pain which can cause us problems. There's many different causes of pain. And there's the fact that the entity of pain is fundamentally... a subjective experience. Mm. So we've got lots of different causes of pain. And if you take a pain clinic, for example, a good proportion of our patients will experience back pain with or without leg pain in the form of sciatica, mm-hmm. Neck pain, some different sorts of musculoskeletal pain, and some patients have nerve pain. Mm-hmm.
Just to stop there, so just recapping a bit. So I'm a consultant in sports and exercise medicine. So I deal with the shit that's broken down.
Yep.
But you're dealing with the pain, which is different. Is that correct?
Well, it's a bit of both. The problem is with long-term pain is that... So if you look at short-term pain, if you look at acute pain, that's what we call short-term pain. Mm-hmm. Short-term pain fits with a medical model pretty well. So... by and large, I don't want to see somebody with crushing central chest pain radiating to their jaw and right arm mm-hmm. In pain clinic, because
they go to
A&E. That's it. That pain has a medical cause uh-huh. Until proven otherwise. And in terms of short-term pain, there is a connection between the degree of tissue injury, the pathology, and the pain experience. We know that if you cause serious trauma to a limb, for example, then it's going to hurt, mm-hmm. and it's going to hurt a lot. And we know that we can't do big operations causing tissue trauma without morphing like drugs to mm-hmm. An anesthesia to help the patient through that time.
Mm. So all in all, most, correct me if I'm wrong, but most consultations... when you're going to A&E GP, are driven by pain.
Yes, that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So pain is...
acute pain serves a purpose. It signals that something's wrong.
Yeah.
You go seek help.
That's right. If you have short-term pain and you feel unwell with it, you go and see a doctor. A doctor will examine you and hopefully come up with a management plan and a diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, it could be antibiotics, medicines, interventions, surgery. But the point is, for short-term pain, it's more likely... to have a medical cause than long-term pain.
Fine. And so you don't deal with that. So
no.
You're dealing with a different subset.
As an anaesthetist, I deal with short-term pain around the perioperative period. As a chronic pain doctor, the pain that we're interested in dealing with is chronic pain. And that's mm-hmm. beyond 3 months. So pain that's persisted beyond 3 months.
Okay.
And
so you have, I've watched a video of yours online and you've beautifully explained the concept of chronic pain. But would you mind repeating it now?
Long-term pain, that connection between the degree of pain that the patient experiences mm-hmm. And the degree of tissue damage or damage, mm-hmm. It's a very weak link, and it's often completely divorced. So a patient mm-hmm. can have, say, for the sake of argument, severe low back pain with only modest wear and tear change demonstrated on an MRI scan. Mm. And the problem is with chronic pain, so pain that's been present for more than 3 months, is that the biomedical model doesn't work very well. The chronic pain, the aspect that's significant is that it's a disease entity in its own right, and the degree of damage or degeneration of body tissues correlates very poorly or not at all with the pain that the patient experiences.
Yeah. So how I explain it, and correct me if I'm wrong or I should sort of rephrase it to my patients, and hopefully you won't, is that acute pain, there's acute pathology and there's something wrong. But mm-hmm. then often if it goes over 3 months, it's classified as chronic pain.
Correct.
And then most of the time, all of the tissue's healed. Then we're dealing with something, I say, yeah, there's an aerotype equivalent of nerve fibres going to and from the brain. They signal pain during those 3 months. But if we haven't controlled the acute pain, sometimes the brain and the body put down sort of a motorway network of nerve fibres. So signalling, taking signals to the limb and then back to the brain. And then we're dealing with like an over-the-top sort of pain response. And the problem's no longer in, say, the shoulder, but it's actually with the nerves or maybe the brain or the perception of things.
It's the processing. So what we used to think was that, you know, hundreds of years ago, we used mm-hmm. to think of the pain system as just a wire, like a telegraph wire. So mm-hmm. if you hit your thumb, the painful impulse travels from your thumb up the arm, up the spinal cord to the brain, and an alarm goes off and says, ow. Mm. We now know that the pain system isn't just a wire, it's actually a processing system. So if you have a severe pain insult or a pain insult that's ongoing, so for example, the pain of a wear and tear condition, an osteoarthritis mm-hmm. condition, then you can develop changes in, so a continuous painful signal. You develop changes in the spinal cord where there's a volume control on that mm-hmm. pain signal. Mm. And the volume at the spinal cord level on the painful signal is turned up. And the pain signal then ascends to the normal pain signal, then ascends to the thinking, emotional processing and stress activation areas of the brain. And that's quite normal to have a pain signal. That's why pain is associated with concepts such as suffering. You get an emotional reaction to a painful signal. And in a long-term pain signal, changes happen in the central processing. You get central hypersensitivity where the pain signal is not turned down as it should be. So what that means is that it's not helpful for a body to develop long-term low back pain. It doesn't serve any useful purpose. An acute pain signal serves purpose. So if I put my hand in a flame, the acute pain signal says, don't do that because that's going to cause you harm. You withdraw your hand, the tissue heals, you learnt your lesson, and the pain goes away. But chronic pain, it has no value mm-hmm. And it doesn't go away. And it's not just a wire, it's a fault with the processing system. So you get changes in all aspects of the pain system, which continue to propagate that painful signal.
That's a far more sophisticated explanation than mine.
thank you very much. I'm trying to show some specialist knowledge and not steal the thunder from their musculoskeletal doctor.
No, thank you for explaining that. I think that's a really nice sort of way of understanding the concept.
Yeah, so it's in the acute pain, that's medical till proven otherwise. In chronic pain, a lot less so, and sometimes not at all. And also the other significance of chronic pain is that often there's nothing to correct. So if I've got pain due to as a musculoskeletal problem, say an orthopedic problem due to a fractured limb, and the orthopedic surgeon fixes that and immobilizes the fracture and stops it flapping around, gives it time to heal, then that pain signal should be done. And the incentive that the body gives us to not take risk and hurt ourselves is useful. So a short-term pain signal is useful. A chronic pain signal is not useful. But it's a huge problem. And in terms of acute pain problems...
Sorry, you probably did give the stats at the beginning, but I've forgotten already.
it's a huge problem. So it's something like 30% of the population suffer with a chronic musculoskeletal pain of some sort, and about 10 or 11% of the population of a developed country state themselves to be severely functionally impaired by long-term pain. It's a huge problem. And... acute pain problems, because there's a medical diagnosis and often a medical treatment, medicine's better for that. So the concept of the medical industry is better for that. But chronic pain, it's a lot more subjective. It's divorced from the degree of the degree of pain is divorced from the degree of tissue damage, and it's a real problem. It's a condition of epidemic proportions, if you like, and we don't have wonderful treatments. We've got some useful treatments, but there's no cure, as it were, for chronic pain. In terms of you asked me earlier about what I would like to convey to patients, I believe, and with this explanation of chronic pain, what we're dealing with, I think that...
Wait, sorry, just a moment. So my heart sunk a little when you said that there's no...
There's no cure for chronic pain. We have treatments that can be effective for some people, but we don't have a one size fits all.
What's the difference between a cure and a treatment?
Well, a cure would be where the disease, in this case the chronic pain, would go away.
But a treatment?
But the treatment is targeting some aspects of the condition. In this case, in chronic pain, we're targeting pain, the pain itself, or more often that the functional impairment associated with the pain. Right.
But you could get symptom free with the treatment.
You can.
Yeah,
you can. It depends on. There's so many different causes of chronic pain.
Yeah,
we can make a substantial impact on symptoms. And
so there's hope, right?
There's always hope. There's always hope. Because although we don't have a cure, so let me explain. So if you look at the medicines for the treatment of pain, they're pretty good for short-term pain. So, you know, we can do, morphine-like drugs are highly effective for short-term pain. We can't do any degree of sophisticated surgery without them. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen, they're pretty effective when you bang your elbow and you get some swelling associated with that. Paracetamol's not bad for a headache. And we have some anti-nerve pain agents which are not bad for short-term nerve pain. But by the time that pain becomes prolonged, whatever the source of the pain is, the medicines are a lot less effective than we hope they're going to be.
Repeat that last thing again.
So by the time the pain becomes chronic, the medicines targeting pain are a lot less effective than we hope they're going to be.
Okay. So, and not to answer my own question, the first question that I've asked you, but for me, I know that it's really important. The one thing that I want my patients to understand is that treating acute pain is so important.
Yes.
Because I don't want it to escalate to chronic pain, because that's a, excuse my French, but it's a bitch of a condition to treat.
It really is. And
especially if you can't find a cure.
I agree, acute pain conditions need to be targeted assertively. You won't always develop a chronic pain condition, but I think good assessment and treatment of acute pain problems that require assessment intervention, I think that's highly prudent.
Why do patients struggle to manage acute pain? Why don't they like to? I can speak from my experience, but from your experience?
Because it hurts.
But why don't they take tablets? So things hurt. So they've got acute pain. They've got knee pain. Why don't they want to take tablets?
I don't think people like taking tablets because medicines can have side effects. Like, for example, ibuprofen, like drugs, can give you indigestion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some people fear masking the pain. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a fear response as well when you injure yourself. You're not quite sure where you are. I mean, when I broke my ribs as a boxer, mm-hmm. I knew what it was, and my ribs kind of clunked around a little bit. Mm. But I wasn't frightened by it. I knew what to expect. Yeah. It was still extremely painful. But
the one thing is that we know what's going on.
Yeah. I took painkillers for quite a short period of time. And I took that for a short period of time, and then I felt comfortable to stop it. And there was no kind of fear associated with that because I knew that I'd broken my ribs, even though they were moving.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that bothered me.
Sorry to cut you up, but patients also, and I don't know whether it's a section of society that I manage, but patients don't like the concept of toxicity of medications.
Agreed.
Building up in your system.
Yeah.
You know, when I say, oh, just take regular paracetamol, full dose, 10 days, but they don't like this idea of taking something very simple, but taking it for so long and four times a day. Why is that?
I think that's a really interesting point. So to take a simple medicine like that, I suppose that there's, in lots of people's minds, there's a gap, isn't there? You know,
but like drinking two bottles of wine over the weekend, and that's not, there's not a judgment call there, but that's societally...
On a Saturday night, Dr. Christopher.
Saturday, Sunday, Friday, maybe, you
right,
know, the whole
okay,
weekend.
Okay, thanks
you
for know, clarifying.
That's acceptable. But we have a level of tolerance, like, yeah, that's done, but that too has problems, you know, as a toxin, if you want
to
call it that.
Almost with acute pain, people, the inclination, I guess, is to soldier on until the pain is severe, and then you've got to do something about it.
But I'm asking the expert here, is there a toxicity associated with the medications? Do they build up? Do they store themselves in fat?
Well, I think you've got to be wanting to treat pain that, so you've got to have a degree of severity to the pain. So if you take musculoskeletal pain, somebody once asked me, you know, in the gym, it hurts when you go to the gym, or it hurts when you go for a walk, depending on your level of activity. Patients have a huge different range of activity. But what's the point at which you should stop? And I said, well, you know, aching pain that doesn't bother you too much is consistent with working the muscles and with exercise, but sharp pain tends not to be. Mm-hmm. And I think the indication for treating an acute pain musculoskeletal condition is to my mind pain that restricts function. Now, simple analgesics such as paracetamol and ibuprofen, they do have risks and side effects. Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, the risks of paracetamol with longer-term use...
Don't tell me it's worse than ibuprofen.
They're very similar. They're very similar. Okay. So if you take ibuprofen for a given period of time, the longer you take it, the more likely you to have risks of heart attack, strokes,
stomach ulceration. Correct. But
how long is a piece of string? And the rheumatology doctors who deal with patients with long-term inflammation from their joints, they are more likely to recommend the use of these medicines for the long term. The way that we would rationalize that the way that we deal with that in clinical practice is the principle of the lowest possible dose of the drug for the shortest possible period of time. So that's how you minimize your risk of analgesics. Don't take it for too long.
But 10 days, I'm really going to push you on this.
In young people without risk factors, with pain in a joint or in a muscle that impairs function, I think 10 days would be a reasonable amount of time to take a painkiller.
Are there associated risks with that?
The risks are not zero. There's no absolutely safe dose, and particularly somebody who had a heart attack.
Or duration, you're saying.
Or duration, and I think it's risk to benefit.
Exactly. And so this is what I want to get to as the musculoskeletal doctor, as the SEM doctor, sports and exercise medicine. you're always weighing up the benefits and the risks.
Yeah.
So what are the benefits that you're going to get from controlling the pain and then being able to engage with physiotherapy, then being able to move? So I just want to make sure that we are talking about a balanced...
Agreed.
And the patients don't worry too much about still being hesitant to engage with medication. I feel like a pill pusher now that I'm speaking to you, but I really do encourage them to take medications, just because I know that if you don't control that acute pain, it goes on to chronic pain, which is your area. And if you don't control that acute pain, your muscle fibers, your motor units start switching off. Rehabilitation then becomes harder. You can lose a lot of muscle mass. There are so many complications associated with MSK.
This is the interesting crossover between your specialty and mine, because you really see that consequence of not analgesing the patient and to enable compliance with physical therapy. And I think in the acute phase...
To aid tissue healing that your body...
Agreed. I think that given that, I mean, you're much more likely to be dealing with acute rehabilitation than me. And I would defer to your expertise in that regard. The only other thing I would add is that if there's a fracture, then non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can believe to interfere with bone healing. Mm. But this is the crossover, as I see it, between your specialty and mine, is that you do need, if you need to... get control of that pain to facilitate critical rehabilitation, then a short course of analgesics is entirely reasonable.
More than not doing it.
Yeah.
Or the risks associated with that medication.
I think there's a balance, and it's up to the SEM doctor to assess.
Yeah, correct. That. And these clinical decisions are personalised, and they are bespoke to the individual who presents to you in the room.
Yeah.
And those are calls that we need to make when we assess the patient.
Yeah, agreed. That's exactly right. And I think...
I guess, if I'm to be honest, I was maybe a little sad to hear that, you know, paracetamol, yeah. you wouldn't necessarily say, okay, just before you see the sports medicine doctor, it's okay to self-prescribe, you know, 5 days
of
regular paracetamol.
It is.
Okay,
I mean, these are drugs that are over-the-counter medicines.
Fine, and so it's safe.
And it's reasonable. I mean, the simple fact is the patient can make a judgment before they see the SEM doc. And I think that that's entirely reasonable. I think the problems with... Essentially, once the doctor advises the patient to continue medicines, particularly in the longer term, then we do have to be aware of the risks. Mm-hmm. But these are over-the-counter medicines, and I think it's entirely reasonable for patients to make their own judgment on that. And I think it's entirely reasonable for the SEM doctor to make a judgment on the indication for a short course. Mm-hmm. And I would have a low threshold for using a short course of simple medicines to facilitate rehab. Mm-hmm. You know, it's movement's critical, and rehab is critical.
The benefits outweigh the risks associated with medication. That's the call we're making in clinic, and
that's the call.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to help explain to the general public. So maybe sometimes that they can make that call at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially if it's with over-the-counter medications.
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. I think that it's not weakness or masking symptoms, which is a common thing that a concern from patients that I hear.
I would even go as far to say a misconception, right?
Yeah. It's not weakness and it's not masking symptoms to take painkillers while things get better, but particularly to facilitate rehab.
To continue moving.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. I think there is very much a judgment call. My advice to a 70-year-old would be a lot different to a 30-year-old.
That's why you come to see us in clinic.
Exactly.
You see your GP, because this isn't medical advice. But what I want to do is just help people understand the concepts behind clinical decision making.
Exactly.
So we can help educate.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think Yeah, so you basically want to help the patient understand the indication for for short-term simple analgesic use. I think that's really reasonable, and I think it makes sense to empower the patient to make those decisions. And I get your point. It's the patient doesn't necessarily need to be afraid or fear masking symptoms if they've made their own risk
and,
a
and not
risk
to go
assessment.
On too much about this, but when I ask patients, because I truly am curious as to why they don't want to take these tablets, I think they're hesitant to, for fear of being judged by a doctor, they're hesitant to fully explain or disclose why they don't. And I do think that there's this level of assuming that medications are toxic. I think there's some narrative there that I hope I'll be able to reveal soon. Is there any weight to that argument? Should people be worried about toxicity of medications or tablets?
I think they
is it the same as alcohol or recreation?
I think the dose maketh the poison. And so I think if you, the accumulative dose, so the dose over time, it is is of concern. And I think, again, it's just the smallest possible dose of drug for the shortest possible period of time.
If I
can bring you back to another point that you made was interesting, was the reasons why people do or don't want to take medicines when you see them in for essentially for acute pain. By the time I see patients taking simple analgesics in chronic pain clinic, it's more the hope that they're going to work. And the smallest possible dose of drug for the shortest period possible period of time principle, you know, it's designed to get that. I see it's designed to stop patients taking drugs in the hope that they're going to be effective in the long term. So an acute pain condition, and by far you're going to see much more acute short-term pain where the analgesic medicines are going to be likely to be effective. By the time I see them in chronic pain clinic, they're not likely to be effective. But it's interesting because patients often continue to take them in the hope that they will be or in the fear of stopping them. And I think that in terms of toxicity, for long-term use of painkilling medicines in chronic pain, I have serious reservations because I think they are quite deeply toxic. Chronic pain and chronic pain patients, this can mean years of treatment for a painkiller, which for chronic pain is at best marginally effective and in the real world, probably not. And I think the challenge for the acute pain doctor, the musculoskeletal physician, is to empower the patient to make their own sensible decision for a few days of simple analgesics to keep them moving. And in your case, to recommend them when you see them in clinic to facilitate rehab and to aid healing. And I think there's a point at which these medicines start to become ineffective. And these simple analgesics are almost invariably ineffective in long-term painful conditions in the absence of active inflammation, such as rheumatoid arthritis. I know you used to see a lot more etoricoxib being prescribed in the long term. But again, my understanding is that the rheumatologists, they don't like these medicines in the long term, and they prefer other disease modifying agents in that regard. So I think it's and I've wondered from your question about how serious are these as toxins in the grand scheme of things
for acute pain management.
Your
area of expertise is chronic pain, but I keep
so
back
yeah
to
for chronic pain. I think it's highly significant to consider the
acute pain.
But acute pain, I think it's really up to the patient and it's really up to the doctor. And no risks are zero, but I think it's if you are functionally impaired and it's needed to aid rehab, I see very little problem with taking. Taking a simple analgesics. So for example, a rib fracture is a good one. You know, you want good control of the pain from a rib fracture, because if you don't breathe, then you're going to get a pneumonia. And And so, yeah, appropriate.
So an infection will build up.
And yeah, like an infection will build up in the chest because you can't cough because your pain is uncontrolled due to your rib fractures. Mm-hmm. And if you have multiple rib fractures and you're an elderly patient, you might even be in hospital with that. It's right. actually life-threatening in elderly people. But if you're a young sportsman who's broken their ribs, you need good, sensible analgesia. And you might need that for longer until you can make sure that you can take deep breaths. I think even in the short term phase, there's a risk to benefit. But as a sport and exercise doctor, you're going to be looking at very small risk from taking short courses of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and paracetamol.
Or even paracetamol. Sometimes I just give them paracetamol.
But you can also give them the exit strategy. I mean, you've told them, you know, you've in your consultation, you've told them the indication for good acute pain control. Mm-hmm. And also empower them with the with the exit strategy, which is when you don't need this anymore medicine anymore, feel free to stop it. Nothing's bad's going to happen once the pain allows and once your function allows. I think that's a reasonable approach.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you for reassuring me that I'm still doing the right thing.
No, that's good. The only thing if I might add in is adult patients who weigh less than 50 kilograms, the dose of paracetamol must be adjusted. And that's one for the audience who might have elderly parents, for example, or be elderly themselves on
50, paracetamol. Not 50 kilograms. Yeah, 500 milligrams four times a day.
Yes, that's the simplest. The doctor can work it out exactly. But essentially, the simplest way to keep a patient safe is if you weigh less than 50 kilograms, take one tablet, 500 milligrams, four times a day, and that will keep you that will keep you safe.
Perfect.
Okay. Exactly.
I may have distracted you because you were going to share some. What was the response to my first question? Was which concept are you going to share with the general population? And it may have been acute pain management. I don't want to.
What I wanted to share with the population, with the patient population, is movement and activity. I think if there is a big, there's two big points I would like to raise. So movement and activity in chronic pain conditions, critical. We need to find the patients. The patients need to do it and we need to help them. Activity is crucial.
What do you mean by activity?
Movement.
Activities of daily living. Keep moving, keep walking, keep...
Activities of daily living and exercise, some form of exercise. There's got to be something, no matter how functionally impaired you are.
And does a physio usually help with that?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Physio is so important and I really feel that... I really feel insurers, actually, I'm going to criticise insurers here. I really feel insurers I don't think they pay physios enough. And I don't think that they pay for enough physio because good physical rehabilitation early. It can take months, but it keeps patients away from doctors and more expensive interventions, and it makes patients better.
Yeah.
So I think physical therapy is really important.
Because you're also facilitating the body to mend itself and heal itself. And that's how
in the acute phase, correct. And in the chronic phase, you're maintaining the function. Mm-hmm. Not moving is painful. Mm-hmm. If you lie on a sofa for 3 weeks, you will be in pain. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with patients who, I exaggerate, but we're dealing with patients who've gradually felt that they're less and less able to move in chronic pain clinic. And the long term, the chronic pain is telling them that they're not going to be, that they shouldn't move, which is an erroneous signal in the majority of cases. And we need to help the patients get the most out of their life and also function, because you can end up in a virtuous spiral where you improve your function, it improves your function and it improves your pain. Mm-hmm. Whereas what pain tends to do is decrease movement, which decrease function, which increases pain. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be my first point for the general public is activity, however you choose to do it, however we support you in doing it. The other thing I think I would convey to the general public is that in chronic pain conditions, there is no role for morphine-like drugs. Mm-hmm. Morphine-like drugs are indicated in acute pain conditions, such as limb fractures, such as surgical procedures. And they are indicated.
And this is medication you get in the hospital.
This is medication you get in the hospital.
But the GP sometimes
And the GPs sometimes prescribe them, and sometimes they get prescribed for too long after after an operation. Sometimes they get prescribed by the GP in the hope that the pain's going to get better to facilitate movement, but that does tend not to happen. And sometimes it's desperation on the part of the patient, but there is no indication for morphine-like drugs in pain that is not due to cancer and that is not acute pain. We know that morphine drugs...
And remind me of what acute pain is. It's pain that lasts?
It's pain for less than 3 months, which is associated with a medical cause until proven otherwise. And so, yeah, that would be my other thing. No matter how bad your fibromyalgia pain is, no matter how bad your back pain is, for chronic pain conditions, steer clear of morphine-like drugs. You will feel pretty good the first time you take them. You might even feel that it improves your pain, but you will tolerize to them. And the interesting thing about morphine-like drugs is that... they decrease the patient's pain threshold.
Yeah, this is interesting.
So the morphine-like drugs lie to you. So the pain threshold for the audience is... So the pain threshold is the point at which the body describes pain as pain. And broadly speaking, it's the same across everybody, cultures, races, genders. If I put a warm electrode on your hand... and I gently heat it, the point at which you say, yes,
Ben. Well, so little old Indian women don't perceive pain differently.
No, they don't perceive pain differently.
They do perceive pain differently.
Sorry, they don't feel... so let me explain. The point at which they will describe pain as pain is is the same as everybody.
Okay.
So the point, if I put an electrode on an old Indian lady, it will be the point at which they say, yeah, that's not warm, that's not hot, that's painful. It will be pretty much the same as a Nepalese Gurkha.
Okay.
They will say, well, it will be pretty much the same as Ant Middleton, the SAS dude. He'll say, you know, yes, Ben, that electrode, that temperature is not a warm stimulus, that's a painful stimulus. They will all say pretty much the same thing. Now the pain tolerance is completely different. The pain, the Gurkhas, Mr. Middleton,
okay, thank you.
They are going to have a much greater pain tolerance than you or I or the majority of the population. And of course, you can train your pain tolerance. But the pain threshold is easier to easier to measure, and we know that after a short perioperative course of morphine, the patient, that we can decrease a patient's pain threshold. So the point at which they describe pain decreases. So morphine-like drugs, they treat pain, but at the same time, they make you more likely to feel pain. And if we prescribe morphine-like drugs for a long period of time, particularly at high dose, you get what's called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, where everything becomes hyperalgesia. Yeah. So you get the morphine-like drugs making things too painful.
Worse.
Yeah, exactly. And so morphine-like drugs, they lie to us in long-term pain conditions. In cancer pain, it's different because in cancer pain, yes, the dose tends to go up throughout the patient's life, but you've got an ongoing cancer process. So the balance is different. And we know that morphine-like drugs are not guaranteed to be helpful in cancer pain, but they are generally an effective medicine. And we know they're effective for short-term pain relief.
So is this something that you practice? Is it a guideline?
The guidance is a bit blurry because some sources say that they're not as robust as they should be. So if practice varies across the UK, and we're pretty robust about not using medicines for chronic non-cancer pain. So other centres can be a bit more optimistic, but the elephant in the room is that we don't have any evidence that morphine-like drugs are effective for chronic pain conditions for more than 3 months, and we've got evidence of a considerable degree of harm associated with that in terms of fractures, premature death.
So if I was
we see that in the States, we see horrendous. That means in the States, And most of the indication, most of these drugs are managed for prescribed for chronic non-cancer pain in the States. You are more likely to die in the States from an opioid that you get from your doctor than from your dealer. Mm. And the Americans really struggle with strong opioid-related deaths. It's a huge problem for them. So stay clear. In terms of prescribers as GPs and in terms of patients as well. But the thing that we know is that beyond 120 milligrams of morphine equivalent in a day, mm-hmm. there's no point increasing the dose, mm-hmm. Because all you do is that you increase side effects. Mm-hmm. So some pain doctors, in my opinion, fall into the trap of saying, well, let's give that 3-month period, that 3-month trial, mm-hmm. and see if we can leverage mm-hmm. function. Mm-hmm. But in my opinion, mm-hmm. that's
the beauty of medicine. Happen.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's true. It's true.
It's not too prescriptive. To some extent, I wonder whether patients get confused because they say, well, this doctor said that this was a good idea, and then you're saying exactly the opposite. And it's not that we don't know what we're doing.
I think if you look at strong opioids, it's mm-hmm. the exit strategy is not clear to the patient. Mm. So it's one thing, for example, for a GP to try a strong opioid pending doing something else, mm-hmm. Which again, I would really try hard not to do. But GPs are human beings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're trying something in the short term, mm-hmm. With a view to something else happening, but that treatment's not successful, say spinal injections, so you're hoping that a spinal injection will be effective for your back pain and radicular pain, and you and the patient's desperate, and you try strong opioid therapy anticipating that a pain doctor or a spinal surgeon will do an injection, mm-hmm. And then that injection doesn't work, you're in a bit of a pickle. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why why everything is a slightly grey area. Mm-hmm. But I can't state it strongly enough. Strong opioids in chronic non-cancer pain, stay clear, even in the short term. They cause significant harm, particularly when they're prescribed with other sedative medicines. Yeah. And the evidence is they are not helpful.
Okay, thank you. And so that's your response.
That's my two things. I think
you're very generous. I asked.
Oh, no, it's part of the service. One for patients. Well, actually, both are for patients and prescribers. Really, the importance of activity.
Oh, so that sort of maybe rolls into the next question.
Mm.
What one thing would you like to share with your GP colleagues?
And also for patients, we're doing some exciting work at Queen's. Mm. We've recently started a neuromodulation service. We've mm-hmm. started to use spinal cord stimulators, and we're keen to offer this new treatment to patients with pain that persists after spinal surgery. That was mm-hmm. previously called failed back surgery syndrome, and we're keen to pick up patients with neuropathic pain due to their diabetes. And we're keen to pick up patients with neuropathic pain due to chemotherapy, mm-hmm. All those conditions can be targeted by spinal cord stimulation. Spinal cord stimulator is like a pacemaker of the spine. It's a wire implanted up the back in the epidural space with a battery pack attached. And it can be helpful for the aforementioned conditions. We're building this service at Queen's Hospital, and we're very proud of that.
And then our final question is, what's the most exciting thing that you've come across that you want to share with your consultant?
Yeah, I think it's the development of our neuromodulation service. Really mm-hmm. excited that mm-hmm. That we're able to offer that now.
Yeah.
And why
is it exciting for you?
Because it's an effective treatment that can really help people. I'm feeling quite excited about multifidus stimulation, mm-hmm. which is another type of implant which stimulates the multifidus, which is one of the muscles of the spine, which stabilizes the spine. Mm-hmm. There's evolving evidence that can be helpful in lots of different sorts of back pain. And again, that's going to be a service that we should hopefully be able to offer over coming months that you can refer into through the NHS.
Excellent. Thank you, Ben, for coming.
It's my pleasure.
For speaking so well.
Thank you.
For keeping me engaged as well as our producer.
She's still awake.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. No problem at all. Anytime.